Giant's Voice.
The official podcast of the U.S. Navy's largest overseas installation, Commander Fleet Activities Yokosuka. This is the Giant Voice Podcast.
Let's start. Today on the podcast, we have Mr. Matt Millett Winfrey, PhD, and he is the clinical child and adolescent psychologist at Naval Hospital Yokosuka. Nice to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
We're happy to have you here. We also have Lieutenant Commander Tan Wen, MD, child psychologist, behavioral health department at Naval Hospital Yokosuka.
Yeah. Hey, David. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. We're glad to have you. And then Mrs. Kristen Jacobs-Schmidt. She is the school counselor at the new Yokosuka Primary School.
Yep. Excited to be here. Thanks.
Nice to have you, ma'am. And what we are going to talk about today is parenting. Some common parenting challenges. And like we've done with sort of our mental health episode and, you know, what to expect when PCSing and this type of stuff, we're going to go over some kind of common challenges, stuff that you might face that's military specific, stuff that's a bit more general, but kind of some tips, strategies to deal with some of the common challenges in parenting. I'm a parent. Parenting isn't easy. It's a lot of work, right? So hopefully we'll demystify some things and talk about some good stuff. And there we go. So why doesn't everybody real quick give me a little bit of a breakdown of kind of what you do, what your specialty is, and what your interest is on the podcast today as far as talking about parenting?
Sure. I'll start. This is Matt Millett Winfrey, psychologist with EDIS, division of the Navy Hospital that supports a lot of my work is in support of school students here. I do a lot of assessment of children that might be struggling in school because of potential emotional or behavioral issues. Excuse me. But interventions for children and families is more of a passion for me. And
right on.
So this is a great chance to kind of keep myself fresh and some of the things that I don't do as much in my current position. So I've spent a lot of time working with parents on increasing their ability to manage children's behaviors at home and to create adaptive relationships.
Okay.
And so I'm hoping that maybe it can talk a little bit about some of the more easy to implement universal kind of things that you can do to improve your relationship with your child. I think that's something that is maybe particularly relevant for military folks, especially those that are faced with long deployments and long absences. You know, leaving a home for an extended period
it's
of time,
really hard, yeah,
and then having to come back.
And reinitiate, potentially
rebuild a relationship with a child. You know, there's no magic quick fix to that, but there are certainly some things that you can do to foster that relationship. And maybe we can talk a little bit about that today.
Right. Yeah. 100%. Well, again, glad to have you. Lieutenant Commander Wen, or Dr. Wen, which goes first?
You can call me that dude for all I care, but yeah.
All right.
Doc Wen's fine.
Go for it.
Yeah. Dr. Wen's fine. Lieutenant Commander Wen's fine. A little bit intimidated by how much wisdom's around me right now, because I am the newest guy on the block. I've only been here for about 4 or 5 months, really getting to know what the families of the military is like over here, and, you know, some similarities from my training at Walter Reed, but definitely a lot of differences as well. So some might be wondering out there, what's a child psychiatrist? For the kiddos, I tell them that I just have to finish 26th grade. For others, I tell them that I work with adults, but then everyone else as well. And so I kind of like to think of myself as the contextualizer.
Okay.
To make sure that everyone's, care, treatment, as well as all of the stakeholders are talking with one another. And then, yes, the cliche part of medication and stuff like that, as well as their medical care. But I truly find that my cup is refilled working with families and the kiddos, so definitely happy to be here where it's much needed as well.
There's something really magic about kids where it's so like challenging and difficult, but
yeah,
then afterwards it's something like what you just said, your cup feels kind of full, right? It's a good feeling, right?
We still have kids, right?
Yeah. Ma'am, all right, and obviously you work with kids every day.
I do.
But why do you want to be on the podcast today? What's, yeah.
Well, myself, I grew up in a military family, so I have experience from being a military brat myself. And then I have been with the DOD since 2005, and I've been with DODEA since 2011. And understanding kind of like what Dr. Millette Winfrey was saying, the resources that we have, the small waking hours that we actually have with our own personal children, especially as they become of school age, and how we can make that a better fit and a more enjoyable time for the family unit so that we can enjoy and help our kids foster and gain life skills so that they can have a productive life and a happy one.
That's awesome. That is a weird thing, though. It was for me of just like my kid goes off to school now and he has his own little life that I don't know anything about. And that's just so like, it's such like a bittersweet feeling when they first start elementary, you know? All right, so let's talk about some examples of some common challenges, and that can be parenting-wide or military-specific. So what are some of the common challenges with parenting? Obviously, there's a lot, right? But what are some of the big ones that you guys, that people are coming for help on, let's say, right? What are some of those?
Maybe I could start. I think something that I hear a lot from parents is a difficulty with being able to connect with their child meaningfully about their daily life. So you know, your child, sort of like you mentioned, your child comes home from school,
right,
and has this life that you don't fully understand.
What'd you do at school today? Nothing.
Yeah.
Exactly. And often the conversation stops there. You know, and I think parents sort of learn to accept that sort of distance, that lack of, you know, well, they're living their lives. Everything seems fine. You know, nothing probably means okay. You know, and. But then at the same time, feel like maybe there's something missing in their relationship. Would like to be able to have more of a deeper shared experience, you know. So I think, you know, that's not a really hard-hitting acute problem, but I think something that a lot of people struggle with, and you do have to, I think, put some effort into relationship building in order to promote those kinds of conversations to be able to have that kind of relationship with your child.
Right on. Yeah, my son, nothing, every day, nothing. And then they have this thing where you can buy pictures. They have like a camera guy come to school, right? And it's very, very Japanese. And you go on a website and they have all these pictures. And there's one of my kid on a horse. You didn't tell me you rode a horse? And he's like, oh, yeah.
No big deal.
We always call those like the monosyllabic response, especially as they become a teenager. Is, you know, it's fine.
Fine.
Good. And then they just go on. And you're like, wait, give me more.
Just something, man.
I really love that maybe you didn't sign a permission slip for the horse either.
So. Well, Japan doesn't do permission slips. In fact, you sent your kid to school, that's their permission slip.
Yeah, I love it.
They took them to the zoo, right, in Zoorasia down in Yokohama. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, they need chaperones or something. I'm in my American brain. No, they just let the kids out at the zoo. Yeah. A bunch of 7-year-olds. Go, be back here at this time.
Yeah.
All right, so what are some other common challenges, common stuff you guys hear?
I hear that as well a lot, and then trying to help parents understand simple ways to build those relationships. More like in the school setting, I'll use like a perspective journal, but at like dinner time, eating a meal or coming together in the evening as a family or in the morning, I think is very important. And kind of talking about your high lows of the day, I think that's one way that we can have a relationship with our family and role model for our children. Also, what was the best thing about your day and what was the improvement area? So it doesn't necessarily have to be bad or good, but what was it? It also helps our families and role model for our children too about our strengths and improvement areas as a life skill as we go on. Ooh, today at work, this went really well. I got to ride a horse. That was very exciting at school.
Right.
The improvement area was, you know, maybe I fell off the horse or maybe that I didn't get to feed the horse and next time I didn't vocalize. So I'd like to actually maybe feed or brush down the horse next time. You know, how can we kind of build those experiences and kind of reflect and make it more of a shared experience so that we can all enjoy each other's time when we're together.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, the dinner thing's an important.
Going back to the idea of the relatability piece, it's like, what do I relate to? Like, who are their friends? What are these horses? and I actually wonder if it's also the same emotion being felt back from them. It's like, this is a very different time in my life than what maybe Dad went through.
Yeah.
Because maybe he did need a permission slip. And so now we're both at like the stalemate of like, okay, who's gonna be curious first?
Who's gonna take the first step across the bridge?
Right? Mm-hmm.
Interesting. All right, what are some other common ones? I think we'll dig into that a little bit more. But some other common stuff you hear.
I think this might be out there quite a bit is electronics, cell phone, social media, and the acceleration of technology that maybe I'm not a parent yet, but folks are trying to catch up with while the kids are just picking it up as if it's like riding a bike.
So I'm kind of not chronically online, but I have long been involved in message boards, and I was a very early Redditor and all of this type of stuff, right? So I think I have a better comprehension of a lot of it than a lot of people in their 40s.
Yeah.
And because of that, I'm like a tyrant. He's not allowed anywhere near it. Because I know exactly what is out there.
That's fair.
I don't know if that's the best solution. Honestly, he's going to find it one day or another. Mm-hmm. And so maybe that's a good question is, right, like, where is that balance between I don't want you to touch this because I know the dangers that are out there, but then also understanding that it's going to be a part of their lives no matter what we do.
Sure.
So what do you do?
It's such a good question, and it's a nuanced answer, and I think that there's a spectrum of adaptive electronics use. You know, obviously there will be a point when your son will be exposed to all the things. Is not being exposed at, you said, 7, 8 years old, almost.
He's about to turn 8.
Maladaptive in some way? I don't think so. I think there've been millennia of years to where children have grown up adaptively without screens. But at the same time, it's a pretty necessary tool to succeed in society in a lot of ways. You know.
Yeah.
Maybe there's the one end of the spectrum where you cut it off completely. What are the downsides of that? Maybe, you know, losing a leg up with some peers and some various technical platforms, right? Nothing that's unsolvable at 8 years old.
You know, we play Nintendo Switch and stuff like that, but he doesn't have a phone. He doesn't go anywhere near the internet, you know. Yeah.
Sure. Good. So it sounds like it's not complete. You're not all the way on the one side of the spectrum.
We're not Luddites, but I mean the social aspect,
yep.
Right? The performative social aspects of the internet, to me, I think, yeah.
Yep, for sure. Now on the other side of that spectrum, I definitely meet families and children for whom screen use is a major, really, element of child rearing,
yep.
Where it is used as a babysitter, as entertainment, as education, as a means to give parents a break, you know. And I do believe that there's a point. There, of course, parts of that are super adaptive. That, you know, I've seen children amass amazing amounts of knowledge at a very young age when they're exposed to educational content that they're interested in.
Good for language learning.
Of course. And then at the other end, the other side of that is when children have uninhibited use of screens and are able to access real content that isn't well monitored. And also substitute a lot of human interactions for.
That's my fear, I think.
Yeah, because I mean, the things that happen with screens can be very rewarding, but in very particular ways, in a very specific kind of flashbang kind of means of getting your attention, grabbing your attention, and activating, you know, the the
dopamine,
the reward system in your brain. And that's not always the best thing. You know, if you're trained to be motivated or rewarded, intrigued by the things that happen on screens, translating that to regular life where you typically don't get that same type of charge off of daily
instant
experiences,
reward, right.
That it can affect the way that you relate with the real world. So I think it's a complicated equation. I think, you know, that I think that some of the parents can ask themselves certain questions about their child's screen use. You know, like, you know, what are the how much time is it? How much time does my son or daughter spend on screens? How much time do they spend on school days, on weekend days? That's a question I ask every family that comes into my office for an assessment. And then you can ask what are the circumstances? Why are they? You know, so one question related to that is, are screens a privilege or a right for my child?
Ah, that's an interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah, it's and if they are considered a right by your child, often that can come with some negative consequences. You know, that if you presume that this is mine, I can use it as I wish when I want, then, you know, things like homework or other chores or things
maybe
like that.
Maybe take a back seat to the...
Exactly. So often parents need to reestablish a relationship where screens are a privilege rather than a right and are provided maybe as reinforcers for doing the less preferred stuff that a child might be more reluctant to do. So the role, and then of course things like content, monitoring. What is my child exposed to, and why are they using screens? Is it because they want to learn something? Is it because I am unable to care for them in this moment, and I need the screens, you know, in order to?
Yeah, I mean, I have been to the point where I go, I got to make dinner.
Yep, of course. It was
not now, you know, 7, 8 years old, like it's totally. But when he's 5, and it's like, okay, bro, you can watch 30 minutes of a cartoon while I make dinner. So I'm not. I know that I think every parent does that to a degree. My parents would sit me in front of the TV sometimes, right?
Absolutely. Me too.
So that is what it is. But I think what you're saying is I totally get it. Is like, is it a privilege? Is it something they go, hey, can I watch TV? Versus I have the right to do this. Yeah. Interesting. Ma'am, you talk to kids every day, and you see kids every day in school. How do you feel about you know what I'm saying? Not just screen time, but general kind of exposure to the internet, exposure to social media, let's say. You know, what's your advice to parents with dealing with that stuff?
Well, I think a lot of it is, that had been mentioned earlier, is understanding what your children are viewing.
Right.
One of the simplistic, which is a very simplistic way, and I'm not trying to minimize the issue, but when I explain it to children or sometimes when I meet with families, is electronics are kind of like candy for the brain. In the past, you had talked about, like, when you grew up, one of the big parenting concerns is how much candy is my child eating, because we didn't have this avenue. So now, if you can kind of imagine, would you let your child sit there and eat candy as much as they would ingest electronics, we would see the physical effects on their body, but we don't see the effects on their brain. But it does translate into my particular setting, in the school setting, because a lot of times students will come in and expect that immediate response, or they're not used to dividing their attention between or waiting for 18 other people to get a turn before they get a turn. And so it has a real life skill effect, and we can see that almost potentially immediately when they come into pre-K or kindergarten. If under the years, 8 years and under is more conceptual thinking. Our children learn by seeing, touching, feeling, doing. And so if they only ingest information mainly one way, we've lost a lot of opportunities to help them learn about the other. You can imagine if you give a child a picture of an apple on a screen and you ask them to describe that to you, their answers would be minimal. If you give them an apple, they can feel it, taste it, the color. And then even if you give them a toy apple, there's three different descriptions and three different layers of learning, but they're all an apple. And so how do those translate, again, for me personally, into the school setting, but also at home? How does that translate into the knowledge and the conversations you can have with your child or with your family about that particular apple? It becomes limited if it's only on a screen, potentially, if they're eight and over, right? We have the conceptual thinking, so they can kind of think about, oh, I can take this picture on the screen. We can go look at it at the store and kind of experience the apple. You can kind of understand that as you get a little bit older, but as you're younger, it's right there, what's in front of you. Right. And so as they get those opportunities to expand their conversational skills about their life experience, I think it's an opportunity to help your child learn more about the world in the immediate setting. And so it really benefits them and you in just such a holistic way.
Interesting. It's really cool. That's really cool stuff of just like theory of mind. Like it's really like a lot of stuff I'm into. So that's really cool. I never really thought about it like that, about the way their brain is kind of developing there is really, that's kind of neat. Yeah. What about something like, for example, my wife and I, as I said, she's Japanese. She likes video games. I like video games. So we do it together, right? So rather than just handing my son a video game to play, we try to play video games together. And I mean, he does play stuff by himself, but we try to make time where we're all going to do it together.
I think you're setting the family standard, which I think is also a phrase that you could use in any family. Hey, our family standard is, when my children were growing up, it was the same, but with DVDs. It was their responsibility to check the back of the DVD to see if it was a G or a PG or a PG-13. That was something that they could recognize from an early age. So even if they were at a friend's house, which again, nobody wants that mom, right? But what is the movie? Oh, my mom says I can't watch PG-13,
right?
Because I'm only 7. But I think the same is true of video games, that you can instill that responsibility of having them check content for your own family standard.
Yep.
And then, hey, it worked this time or it didn't. And then you can have that conversation about it. So
that's cool.
I think there's a lot of skills that can be done at an early age with electronics.
Yeah. Learning to self-regulate a bit. Yeah. Right on. So I'm going to bring up the one here. And this is, I think every parent has felt this, of getting your kid to listen to you. And I once read, like, don't argue with an 8-year-old because you're gonna lose, mm-hmm. right? Their will is way stronger than yours is ever gonna be.
Yep.
But I mean, I feel like with my experience personally has been pretty typical. I my son doesn't want to listen to the stuff that kids don't. You need to clean your room. You need to help with dinner. You need to whatever, that type of stuff. But what happens when it's something like, I don't know, how about when I was a kid and I patently refused to do homework for years and nobody, no matter what anybody said, I just wasn't going to do it, right? What about situations like that? Like past the regular, oh yeah, kids don't want to listen to their parents, and crossing into stuff that's really rebellious maybe.
Yeah. My usual comeback for parents that bring that question up is, why should they listen to you?
Interesting.
Right? Because, they're very smart, emotional beings that always try to, like, pivot on what emotion is in the moment. So Dad told me that I could play Minecraft yesterday, and then he cut me off 5 minutes before, and I felt slighted, and now he's going to hang the thing over me for me to do dishes, and no, I'm not going to do it because it was 45 minutes instead of 50, and I'll never express that because I don't have the emotional labels for it, so I'll just say no.
Interesting.
Yeah, and so, at the end of the day, you're right. You can't argue with no from an 8-year-old.
You can't out-stubborn an 8-year-old.
That's what I'm going to say, yeah.
But you often can outsmart an 8-year-old. So when you have pervasive difficulties with defiant behaviors, there's actually a really nice evidence base of strategies that have been constantly sort of shown to be efficacious for families with those kinds of issues. And it's no one thing that you do to help a child abide or listen, whatever your goals are, but it's kind of a toolkit, you know, and it involves a number of different components. I think number one, it starts with the relationship building that we kind of led with. It is hard to get a child to listen to you when you haven't built up a bank account of positive experiences. And we can talk a little bit about how you might do that. If you're in the negative, basically if your relationship is constantly adversarial, if most of your interactions involve scolding or prompting or redirecting or criticizing, often that if that's the pattern, it becomes white noise. And if that's all that you hear, then you're not going to tune into it. So there must be different. There must be something on the positive end. There must be some kind of praise, positive attention, recognition, acknowledgement, that kind of stuff, so that you build up so that when you withdraw from the bank account, it's not putting you into the red. You know, being $100 in debt, being $1,000 in debt, it's all in the red.
Yep.
So that's one thing. You build up the positive relationship, and then there are many ways that you can interact with a child that promote adaptive behaviors. It can the way that you give instructions, for example, we're using plain language, making eye contact, often getting at the same level with your child.
Yep.
not making requests in the form of a question like can we do this now, please go up to your room now. And sometimes you might have to provide monitoring afterward to follow them up, you know, setting them up for success so that it's easy to follow an instruction. So the way that you give instructions can matter. And then what the consequences of obeying or disobeying the instructions are matters a lot too. So if the consequence is I'm just going to ask you again and ask you again and ask you again and eventually throw up my hands and give up because you're not listening to me, then
you're encouraging that behavior.
I've just learned that I can out stubborn you and I win and I don't have to do the chore. So I will now next time if you ask me five times this time and I was able to make it through, I bet I can make it through 8 or 9 times next time. And you can sort of build this cycle of, okay, I can wait you out. I can out stubborn you. So if instead a request is either followed, if your child complies with going up to the room and cleaning it and you come up there and you give him immediate specific praise for that, like, man, I know you didn't want to do this. I know you were in the middle of a video game and you went up here to your room and you started picking up toys. I'm so proud of you. That's really amazing. You know,
that's all. I kind of feel like I do that. You're kind of making me happy. I'm like, wow, I guess I'm not so. You're constantly questioning whether you're a good parent, right? Mm-hmm. Like every day you wake up and think, am I doing this right?
Oh, so you do some of this kind of stuff.
I really try, like, hey, man, thanks. I appreciate you doing that and you did a great job doing it. And I try.
Awesome.
I really do.
Well, then you're hitting on all cylinders. That's really great. And it's
maybe.
But that's not that common. I meet many parents, and with, you know, this is valid. Parents have expectations of what their children should and shouldn't do, and when they don't do them, it's almost an injury. It's an injury to the parent. The parent, you know, like, why aren't you doing what I'm expecting you to do? It you know, and we get into that mode of being either defensive or hurt or mad, you know, right. And
well,
that,
I've been there too.
Happens to everybody. We all have to sometimes kind of pick up the pieces after losing it. That's universal, of course. But if your general sense is, my child must abide by my rules, period, and that's just how it is, then, you know, that works for some. There are some families have children who are, you know,
they
pretty
thrive
pretty
in that obedient. In yep. that very yep. organized yep. Mm-hmm. sort of scenario.
But when it doesn't work, it can create a pretty big power struggle. You know, yep. that often doesn't end well, and you have to kind of find other strategies to support better behavior. So those are just a couple. Three of the tools in the toolkit.
And one of the questions I always ask as a parent, or I'll ask two parents, is in the moment, if you can ask yourself, kind of like Dr. Millett Winfrey was saying, can you break it down? Is this a will problem for this child, or is it a skill problem? Is the child not able to do the dishes, or are they refusing to do the dishes? And then we have to do maybe a sub-check of, again, are they under 8 years old? Are they over 8 years old? Do they need role modeling on how to wash the dishes, how to separate them or unload the dishes? Or are they flat out refusing because they just don't want to do it? And maybe they're in the conceptual stage and they understand that it's a power struggle. What do you do from there? So if you can ask yourself as a parent in the moment, I think it can change your reaction to your child of, okay, this is a will problem. He or she can do it. They're just choosing not to. So then you might want to ask yourself another question. What is the goal? Is the goal to have the dishes done at this very moment because we're leaving on vacation and we're not going to be back for 2 weeks? So if they sit in the sink, it's going to be a disaster. Or is the goal that the child will do this, the dishes will get done, but they don't actually have to be done at this very moment? Because eventually an older child will want something, food, money, permission to go on sports. Teenagers are notorious for wanting things.
Yes.
So eventually, if you can wait, right, if that works, if the dishes need to be done or they need to learn the skill, then you can role model with a lot of I statements like, well, when I can't do the dishes, I ask for help. Or if I'm struggling with putting or matching the silverware back where it goes, or I can't reach the cupboard, then this is how I ask for help respectfully. So I think if you can stop in the moment and give yourself some grace as a parent, because as we've just talked about, parenting is a tough job.
And giving yourself grace is a tough job.
It is tough.
Sometimes, isn't it?
Yes. But here's a caveat too. Don't worry. The situation will pop up again. And if you didn't handle it perfectly this time, you'll get another chance to improve upon it. And so as realizing that your parenting skills will improve as well as we experience the situations, I think that's important. So if it's your child this time in the commissary that's screaming in the vegetable section, I think if you truly look around, you're just going to see five other parents saying, we've been there.
Of course.
We have been there. Instead of like, everyone's staring at me. No. And I think any parenting will agree. And I just say to myself, it's not my turn today. Yep. It might be my turn tomorrow.
Yes. I totally feel that. I really, really do. You know, what you were just talking about, it just reminded me of like, you said before about learning your sima sense, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, the Japanese language and culture is constructed around this idea of like, if I take care of everyone else, I will get taken care of, right? If I build the net, mm-hmm. I don't have to worry about my own needs because the net is there, right? And that doesn't always work, right? Because that also, when you have a bully or someone who's going to take advantage of that, they really can take advantage of it. But an interesting thing that I noticed is, right, you watch Japanese kids, they're so polite, right? They're constantly using polite language. They're constantly saying sorry when they make a mistake. And I always thought, like, wow, how do they accomplish that? But I watched my wife, and you want to know how? She apologizes to him when she makes a mistake. Mm-hmm. And, like, it's literally just he watches what she does. He goes, I want to have this for dinner. And she's like, well, we don't have this. I apologize, but we have this instead. Sima-sen. This is what we have. Oh, yeah. And so that he learns that behavior, and watching it is like mind boggling to me.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It's wild.
I'm so happy you brought that up because it's mind bogglingly like simple too. It's kind of like you parent how you were parented. And I like to tell folks that we regulate driving much more than we do parenting in the United States. You have to go through a class. 14, you get your permit. At 15, you get your license. At 16, you're on a probational period. Then you got to have insurance, and you got to get the means to get a car, and then the car can be sold. Whereas to be a parent, you have a child. And then there isn't a coach really that gets assigned to you to say, hey, yeah, this is what you should or should not be doing. And then to, you know, like then folks kind of get together to be like, hey, are you going through this? Yeah, I'm going through this. Are you going through this? Oh my God, this makes me feel so much better.
Yeah.
Especially like the commissary scenario, and it really brings that validation to say, okay, maybe I also kind of maybe don't know what I'm doing sometimes.
I feel like I don't know what I'm doing at all. I read a book and I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm doing.
It's kind of like the self-feeding system where you have to go out and strive and look for that information.
Yeah. Man. And then, you know, this is a little off topic, but you look at your kid and there's this moment where you realize, like, I think you think for a while when they're first around of like, oh, he's 50% me and he's 50% her. And he's there's a little bit of me and there's a little bit of her. And then there's this moment where you realize, like, oh, he's neither of us. He's his own little thing that is just, has his own set of motivations and his own way of thinking. And, like, I don't know, that's a weird moment, but it's also really good because you, I don't know, you can relate in a different way maybe. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Yeah, the older and older they get, I usually tell folks that you become a provider and slowly a counselor to them.
Right.
Because, yeah, once they hit 18, I'm going to really hope you don't try to ground them and see how that goes. But, yeah, essentially later on, the question of, like, why they should listen to you will carry over 18. And then you're going to hope that that transition isn't that big.
Yeah.
Well, and it helps them operate. As what they learn in the family, they also carry out to society, like into the school. And school is usually one of the first places they get to practice that. So listening to an adult in a family also translates to listening to a teacher in the classroom, but with, you know, probably 10 times the stimuli. So now I have to gain attention either by raising my hand or not raising my voice. Again, in a classroom setting, that's a little bit different. But practicing those skills while they're younger, how do we treat each other and have reciprocal conversations, translates to great life skills in our society, because then they typically are able to function better in school, which also translates potentially in the workplace, because we all have workplaces where potentially almost all of us have to sit in a monthly staff meeting, right? And then sometimes our attitudes vary about that monthly staff meeting, but it is our job to go, to listen, and to learn something. It is not our job to necessarily be entertained by that information. And so I think helping children learn that at an early age, of developing that skill of sometimes we just have to learn. So how do we be engaged to learn new information, even if it's something maybe we're not interested in or something we've learned before? And how can we sharpen our skills that way? I will tell parents and students, you know, boredom is a state of mind that you control. I've had parents or students come, oh, I'm so bored. Well, again, that's also a choice and a skill. So how can we mitigate that skill and kind of increase our curiosity
to
kind of
figure something else new out? Mm-hmm. I do that with my son a lot, right? His English is behind, right? Bilingual kids, I'm sure you guys know the whole deal. Like they tend to kind of lag in both languages for a while. Very good at Japanese for being bilingual because he's in Japanese school. English, speaks fluently, not good at reading and writing. Got a tutor now, he's getting there. But we'll be looking at something, me and him together. We're going through to find something to watch together. And he's like, what's the name of that? I'm like, I don't know, you read it, man. And it's funny to really watch him understand that, like, oh, if I really get better at reading English, this opens a new world to me of things I can find out and do. So I guess maybe that's an example there, right? Of like, if you're bored, find a way to be curious about something new.
It is true. And like you were talking earlier about, my personal children also grew up in a local national school. They grew up in German school. So they are fluent in German, which their mother is not. So
interesting.
And so, having those experiences and expanding their own, and then they kind of had their own issues that they could talk about. And then in public, they would ask me not to speak German because my German would usually come out sounding like, you, me, go now, as opposed to, hey, are you and I going to? So, and then kind of giving that opportunity and experience to have ownership of it, I think is a good one as well.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, German, huh?
Yeah, I can see that scenario. It's like, Mom, stop, you're embarrassing.
That's exactly
that. We'll get there. I speak Japanese, but I speak heavily accented. I just can't drop the New York out of me, I guess. right now, my son's very proud of me when I speak Japanese. He thinks it's cool. But I know there's going to come that point where he's like, Dad,
I like this girl. Yes. I need you to stop.
Yep.
I think that maybe segues back into a little bit of the conversation about video games. and about valuable interaction time with parents. I think, you know, what you're fostering curiosity and a sense of resistance to boredom is not something that you just, it just happens, you know, particularly if you're, let's say you're playing video games or watching movies for multiple hours a day, and you are being fed someone else's creativity. You're being rewarded on someone else's terms, kind of, you know, rather than you seeking out your own rewards, you finding something new or interesting. I do think that that can inhibit one's sort of self-motivation to kind of explore and to be curious and to not be easily bored. So that goes back to that idea of, you know, what's your kid watching? What's your kid playing? And is it fostering that sort of kind of growth mindset, that the natural curiosity? And if not, then maybe that's the time to consider changing relationship with screens. You know, one thing that I maybe wanted to just talk about briefly is what an alternative to that is with parents. But especially for parents who maybe don't have a lot of time, or maybe, you know, let's say they have a strong relationship with screens. I think there's nothing wrong with playing video games with your family. It's a lot better than playing video games alone. Having that sort of, there's a community there that it's one step away from the isolation that can often happen when you're locked into a screen by yourself. At the same time, I think they're taking a breath, you know, and a step away from that, and having some non-screen based interactions is important. And you know, there's a lot of terms for that. The most common term is one-on-one time. And if I were to have one takeaway for our conversation today, given what we've talked about instilling curiosity, building relationships, reducing screen time, it might be just to map out what quality one-on-one time is. And it's deceivingly simple sounding, but it takes some effort to do. But this is something that I would suggest for, you know, parents coming back from deployment, trying to build their relationships, parents trying to change a relationship between a child and screens, and just parents are trying to maintain a conversation that goes beyond those one word answers when you're coming home from school after a busy day. And it requires a couple of things. It requires consistency. This is something that you do 10 or 15 minutes every day if possible, but at least 3 or 4 times a week, something that you schedule and something where you're able to, again, this isn't easy for everybody, but where you're able to isolate one child, where it's just you and one of your children. And in that span of time, you offer the child the opportunity to do something together that is not related to screens. And some children have many ideas, nothing extravagant like going to Disney World or anything like that, but just something simple that we can do around the house or nearby. This could be anything from drawing to building Legos to taking a walk to going to a park, whatever we can do that relates to your child's interests and that enables you to watch them actively doing something. Because when you pick an activity, your job for the next 10 or 15 minutes is to essentially just 100% or to the extent possible in this small period of time. It's exhausting to do for much longer than this, but completely attend, completely focus on what your child is doing over the course of that task. So you guys were mentioned building Legos on Christmas time. You know, so you're sitting down, maybe you're building Legos together, or maybe you're just watching your son build Legos. And in that span of time, you are kind of like the sportscaster for his Lego building. You're making commentary as you feel comfortable, enthusiastically about what your son is doing. Like, wow, you're really putting that thing together fast, man. Gosh, you that step there was really complicated, and you just nailed it. That little piece there, I thought that went the other way, but obviously you're right. This is really shaping up. What do you think is what's coming next here? Like, sort of showing some interest in what he's doing. Like, you're just zoned in to what's going on with him. You're not criticizing. No backhanded commentary. Like
I wouldn't do it that way.
Sure. Yeah. Right. Or even more subtle stuff. Like, wow, you really picked that up fast. Why can't you do that every time?
God. I remember my mom doing that to me. That's the worst feeling in the world, isn't it?
The hidden backhand.
Yep. Yeah.
And so you're and no major questions like or rules. You didn't follow that right. You didn't follow that step. Go back and fix it. You're just letting it go. Like, oh, this is looking great. You leave your evaluation, your judgment, your set of standards for what your child should be doing out the window for this 10 or 15 minute span, and you're just attending.
It's almost like an active meditation or something,
yeah,
right? You're
yeah.
just trying to like kind of be in the moment with them.
Exactly.
Non-judgmentally or something,
which
right?
takes, some people have that natural gift, but most people
it's
takes
hard.
Work.
Yeah,
it takes
real
hard.
Yep. Yeah.
But the idea there is that in that span of time, you are building that positive attention bank, and you are making it as much on your child's terms as possible. You're not asking them any of the demanding questions about the details of their day. You're not telling them what they haven't done right. It's just them and you showing them that you really care what's happening in their life. Mm. And you start simple with that. You start with something simple, and then as you do that, what tends to happen is the child enjoys that attention. They enjoy that you're noticing them, and they begin to expand the kinds of behaviors that they present in those situations. You might start to get more conversations. You know, it becomes more of
if they feel like they won't be judged, they're maybe going to be willing to share more things.
Exactly.
Because
exactly.
It's safe.
And you can adapt that to adolescents and older children. Obviously, it's a little bit more complicated because they're so much more wrapped up in conversations with high schoolers. But the principle is the same. You go out for ice cream or something like that, and you're just like, let's just talk about stuff that I know that you're interested in. We're just going to keep this just completely about you and without judgment. You know, so you know, maybe if your child is into a certain hobby or something like that, you know, explain to me more about this. You know, to get them talking about something that has nothing to do with your
the stuff you like,
exactly.
And what's yeah. they like, yeah.
But as it becomes safe and it becomes rewarding because you're giving them that feedback. Wow, I never knew that about that singer. You know, where did you learn that? What's next? You know, anything to show your curiosity, without judgment and without criticism. That's one way to foster more, you know, a feeling your child feeling comfortable with sharing more stuff with you. So, one-on-one time for I think. As from toddlerhood up till they leave the house, you can't give them enough of it.
I loved spending one-on-one time with my son. I really do, but I could understand how if you had two kids or three kids or four kids, it just gets like you said, it's hard to make that time, but like you said, it's important to try and make that time. So,
and it doesn't have to be hours a day. Like mm-hmm. I said, 10, 15 minutes a day. If you can set a goal of even just doing it twice a week, if it's 20 or 30 minutes of your day, just focused on that child, wherever it fits. Whether, you know, if you keep them up a little bit later one night or wake them up a little bit, obviously a lot of factors. One gets home from school, after, you know, if you can make that work, even, you know, any commitment that a parent can make to doing that for whatever span of time is possible for them is going to help.
Right. That's great.
And that is like a muscle of curiosity that you're talking about too. It's kind of like the willingness to learn, because you know you're sitting there, you're asking questions, and they're kind of learning about how to do that themselves.
Mm.
And so, what you're talking about the idea of like some of the mitigation or the cure to boredom is the presence of curiosity, and a lot of that is learned as well, and it usually comes from mom or dad being okay with sitting down, not responding to that text, and having something I call joint attention. And it it's even hard for me with my friends when I go out to dinner. I see them like look at their phone, and all of a sudden the attention span is now at 40%.
Oh, it drives me crazy.
I gotta reach for mine now.
That drives me crazy. As you guys, I think, could probably tell, like, I really get jazzed up talking to people.
Yeah.
And so, like, if I go out with someone and they're paying more, it's okay. It's the 21st century. We got to check our messages sometimes. But if you're paying more attention to the phone than us hanging out, we might not be compatible. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And I really hope that, the parents kind of teach their kids that joint attention is a premium nowadays as well.
So my question is what happens when you have a child who, what reminded me of it is where you were talking about this learning time, like learning that, it's not always supposed to, learning isn't always fun, right? Sometimes it's the curiosity and what you're going to get out of learning the new thing. What happens when you have an adult teacher or coach or person who the child just does not get along with?
It's an opportunity, I would call that, because that happens. It's a life skill.
Right.
We've all had supervisors that we get along with or we don't. We've all had friends, like you were saying, that we've decided on what level of friendship we're going to have. So for my own personal children and for my students, I always view that as an opportunity. Because 1 year you're going to have a teacher that you really connect with, and potentially the next year, especially as you move on to middle school and you're changing teachers frequently throughout the day. So it's a life skill, and it's an opportunity to practice that life skill. So how do you teach them in the moment when they don't get along with someone or they want to tune out everything that someone's trying to teach them? How do you do it step by step? Well, first of all, is recognizing it. Why does this teacher upset me so? Is it because they're setting strict boundaries? Is it because they have expectations that I've never had before? Mm-hmm. I said this was due Monday at noon, and you turned it in at 12:05. Therefore, you either get 50% credit or no credit at all. Or as a parent, you must do the dishes. We can go back to the dishes. You have to do the dishes before you can watch TV. What am I used to in my life, or what has my life experience been up to that point? And why is this person frustrating me? So you can also help your child explore, and yourself as a parent, because typically when your child's upset, you become upset. And checking that of what is the goal? What is the life skill here that we can pull out of this? The life skill is that we're going to have to deal with people that we don't always get along with, or I'm going to have to learn from someone or be supervised by someone that we don't always see eye to eye with. How can we function in that environment? And then the other one is, what does it say, or what is it about this particular situation that is difficult for me? And then how can I grow from that? If it's because there's no, potentially the teacher doesn't give any like credence or extensions to the deadline. Well, but my parents always, kind of like what we were talking about earlier, but my parents always, on the fifth time, they say, clean your room, then I know they're serious. So if that's been my life experience up to that point, then of course that would be frustrating.
He had a teacher last year, a Japanese male elementary school teacher, who is very, very strict, very, very Japanese, by the rules, I wouldn't say that we're incredibly permissive parents by any stretch of the imagination, but this is that very Japanese formal strictness, and my son just had a really, really hard time with it. He did very good in school over the year. The teacher spoke very highly of him, but you can tell when he came home, he was just kind of mentally exhausted by the day. And so that's sort of my question is, like, how do you contextualize it? And I think you answered really well.
Well, and I think giving the children the words to explain it, one of the things we teach our children at a very early age in our particular setting is that words and behaviors need to match, and we give them a visual because they're still, and then asking the students, are your words and behaviors matching? Are the teacher's words and behaviors matching? So we can kind of break down the problem. Is this something you can solve yourself? Is this something you need help from a friend or a grown-up? Or is this something maybe we need to go to someone with authority? And so once you break down the problem, then they can kind of figure out, one, where it fits, and then what are the steps to solve that? So,
that's good advice.
Well, ideally, it's a life skill, right, that we can grow from instead of just being frustrated in the moment.
Yep.
And then how does that project past school? Because we only stay in school a certain amount of years, even though it seems like forever.
Voluntarily.
What are we going to do after that? And how are we going to function in our work place? How are we going to function in our social settings? How are we going to function? Because there's going to be, and how do we be selective about who we want to spend our time with?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And grow as a person.
Yeah. Good. Great advice. I appreciate that.
I mean, yeah, the idea of not knowing how to relate to your kid sometimes, right, can be hard because they don't have the labels to kind of match the thought and the behavior. And sometimes we don't know what that word is that they're saying from Urban Dictionary or the new Taylor Swift song, right? The story I have is that when I was interviewing this 14-year-old girl who's telling me about her love life, and like, oh, you know, we were texting back and forth, and you know, there's a med student there with me, and she was like, oh, he left me on red. And then I kind of nodded my head, and then I looked over and I said, ah, okay, what does it mean if he left you on blue? And then the medical student just facepalmed so hard, and I'm pretty sure every Japanese citizen just cringed. I'm sorry. And then they educated me to say, hey, it really means that, you know, they just didn't respond. And I said,
yeah, they did not see your text. Yeah, they saw it and actively chose not to respond.
And I said, yes, okay, of course, I knew that. But let's just play it metaphorically because I'm a psychiatrist and I'm weird. So that was like such an eye-opening like moment for me, because I kind of like, as you were saying, with tech as well, like, man, I cannot keep up, right? So it's not usually a matter of if. It's usually a matter of when they're exposed to things that maybe they don't understand.
And that you can't contextualize for them always, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing, too. You don't know that you're going to help or you can help them contextualize if they don't feel safe to come to you in the first place.
And that brings it all right back around,
yeah,
doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. So that's probably the big thing here, too, that you cannot control for everything, but you're going to hope. You're going to hope that you're safe enough that they can come to you.
I think that's a really, really great place to end right there. And I think everything we talked about today is really great. I told you guys I'm really armchair into this type of stuff. And so I really am quite exhilarated by everything we talked about today. But just to wrap up, right? If you have one piece of advice, one piece of parenting advice that parents should, this is the elevator pitch. Hi, nice to meet you. How do I be a good parent? And then you walk out the door. What's the one piece that someone should take away?
The one piece that you should take away is on January 31st at the Red Brick area next to the commissary, there is going to be a resource fair that our agency, EDIS, is putting on that brings together all of the different child and family support institutions and programs and initiatives that exist on base.
Awesome.
It happens from 1430 to 1800. And MWR will be there, Fleet and Family will be there, DODEA representatives will be there. So it'll be kind of a one-stop spot to get any of these kinds of potential questions answered, or to get any tips, or just to find out what's available for you as a parent and as a family here in Yokosuka. So highly recommend that you attend and do one-on-one time at least a couple times a week.
Excellent. Thank you. And also all the information for parenting resources, we are going to put in the show notes. So if you're listening and you need some resources for stuff, they will be in the show notes for this episode. All right. One thing.
I'll just foot stomp that. Resources are a child psychiatrist's best friend. And that's because we can't do everything. And I will be more than sure to say that I have a hard time trying to figure out if I'm getting burnt out because I'm not using the resources that are provided for me for parents. And so, yes, go to the fair, be proactive, think about the cases, about things that have not come up yet that might, and figure out if those resources are going to be a good fit later on. It's better to have it and not use it than to need it and not know it.
That's good advice in general in life. Yep. All right, ma'am, you're last up.
Well, I would just like to say, enjoy your kids and enjoy some of the things we talked about today, where their thought process, whether you agree or disagree with them. Give yourself credit, because if you don't agree with them, they're individual thinkers and you've done your job. If you do agree with it, they're listening to you and you've done your job. So I would just say, enjoy your kids when they have these behaviors or thought processes that you're curious or frustrated by, just take a breath. Know that it's not going to last forever. They're still your kids. They're still great. And, man, you have a lifetime to be with them. So take advantage of every moment, because as they get older, your time becomes less and less. So just enjoy them and laugh with them, and the relationship will come, I think.
All right, everybody. Thanks again so much. And thanks to the listeners out there. Stay tuned in 2025. We're wrapping up our Welcome Aboard series. We're going to move on to some other stuff. We got some really neat stuff planned for 2025, some kind of personal feature stuff, and some really cool stuff. So stick around. And as always, thanks for listening.